April 4th, year 2002. This is an interview with Julia Cowan. The interview takes place at her residence on Chestnut Street in Lexington, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Ms. Cowan, give me your full name, if you would, please, so I can get a voice level.
Julia Bell Cowan.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for agreeing to talk with me today.
Mm-hmm.
We're picking up, as you know, with some of the interview material that you did back in the 1980s with Alessandra Portelli. Mm-hmm. And I have some additional questions that we wanted to know about you.
Okay.
Could you begin, please, by telling me where and when you were born?
I was born in Cardinal, Kentucky.
Cardinal?
Bell County. Mm-hmm. Bell County, Kentucky. 1925, on May 5th, 1925.
And that makes you how old?
76. In a few days, if I live, I'll be 77.
May 25th, you said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about your family at the time that you were born? Who was in your family?
Well, I was born in a coal mining community in Bell County. My mother's name was Winnie Zellers. That was her maiden name. But her married name was Winnie Smith. That was a married name. And of course, just grew up like they only, it was a little mining camp. And
your father worked
was
in the
a
mine?
Coal miner.
Okay.
He was a coal miner. My grandfather, as far as I know, my grandfather was a coal miner. My uncles, everybody that I in my immediate family around there, they all were coal miners. You had to be, or you didn't live in that community. Because it was a coal mining community, and that was the only industry there. So all far as I can go back and remember, my great-grandfather, great-grandfather, my uncles, they all were coal miners. And my great-grandmother, she ran a boarding house. Like men come there and get jobs. They didn't have families, you know, they would live at the boarding house. My great-grandmother, Kizzy Dyer. She ran that boarding house for men that would come there and get jobs and would stay there until they moved their families there or maybe just leave and go elsewhere.
Okay.
And I grew up in that area. Went to a one-room school. The grades went from what we used to call primer till the eighth grade. And it, all that was in one room.
Now, did you go to an all-black school?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. How many children approximately went to that school?
Well, now, I couldn't be precise, but maybe because in the coal mining area, it wasn't nothing but children. And all the black children went to the black school and white children went to the white schools because there was no such thing as integration down in Bell County or Harlan County, well, down in that part of Kentucky, far as I know. And we went to this one-room school and my gosh, I guess, oh Lord, I guess it was maybe between, I would be safe in saying between maybe 45 and 50 children in that one room.
Okay.
Because they took them from the primer. That's what they, you know, we used to call it the primer. Now I think what they call it now, first grade or something or other. I don't know what they call it now, but it was a primer. And but you didn't start until you were six years old. That's when you started in the primer. And so we all went in that one-room school there in that community.
Let me go back and ask you about the town. How did the blacks and whites live together, or were there separate sections?
It was separate sections.
Okay.
You came to the white, where we call it camp. You come to the white camp first, and then over on the hill, that's where the blacks were.
And was it fairly equal, black and white, or were there more whites than blacks, or?
Well, I would say it was more white than black. But at that time, far as I remember, it was a lot of blacks too, because I've heard my mother and them say they bought them in there, go leave the miners, coal operators would. Just say, for instance, when my father came from Georgia, Alabama, he come to the coal mine, then they would run what you call transportation. They go back home and get their people and bring them up to the coal mines, you know. And they, and now this is what I used to hear them say. Now, I wasn't in the knowledge of this at that time, but I heard them talked about how, you know, if one brother came up, and he's working the coal mine, making good money, or whatever money they were making, it was better than what they had. And they go back home, and they had to, what you call it, sneak them away, steal them away, or something, because down there on the plantations where they were, if the plantations owner knew that they was coming around, slipping them families away, they couldn't have done it. I used to hear them talk about that. And they migrated from down south, Georgia, Alabama, and, you know, places like that. And they migrated from down there up into the Kentucky coal mines. I think that was done just about everywhere it was coal mining, carrying on.
How far did you get in school?
I got to the eighth grade. I never did get out of the eighth grade.
Okay.
Because my stepfather, my mother and father separated when I was too young to know him. Mm-hmm. But she was married to my stepfather, Will Smith, that was his name. And up until he died, I was in the eighth grade. And I had to stop school, because at that time, there were no help for a widow woman with a lot of with kids at all. And I can remember men getting killed in the mines. And their families, I didn't understand it then, but their families would have to pack up and leave and go back wherever they come from or wherever they had folks to go to. And then I can remember this too, that sometime if the husband lost the wife, and it always was a lot of children, that they would, people in the community, you know, would take some of the kids to help raise them. You know, a lot of families got tore up like that because folks would move and you'd never hear your brother or sister anymore, you know. That happened because I didn't realize it was hard times, you know, and folks had a hard time struggling, trying to live. I was just young and didn't understand it.
Right.
But that did happen.
How did you meet your husband?
Oh, my first husband. I've been married twice.
Okay.
Henry Coleman. Met him at Carnal, Kentucky there. And my stepfather had died my mother had eight children and was pregnant with the baby when he died. And I had to stop school and go to work such as to be done there in that community, like domestic work, you know, scrubbing floors, windows, washing, and we took in washings and ironings and things. That's what kept us going. And it was a hard struggle. By this time, I'm understanding all this, you know. And I worked at the boarding house, the white boarding house in the white community. And when they had like a morning shift and an afternoon shift in the coal mine. And I had to be up before day to go down to the white boarding house to help in the kitchen, getting the miners out to their jobs. Then to help, you know, clean, make beds and things. By 1 o'clock, the second shift was getting up. See, they done slept all night. Then I had, that was just the constant thing of making beds and cleaning and help getting them out. And I was doing all of that for $5 a week. $5 a week. That's what my mother would take that money, because she was big pregnant, she was sick. So many times we didn't think she was going to live and take care of my other sisters and brother. Didn't have but one brother at that time. The rest was girls. And
were you the oldest child?
I was the oldest child. And the other children went to school and I went to work. I worked a many times. I look at these shoes, they call buddies, you know. And at that time, they wasn't but about 50 cents, 25, 30 cents, whatever. And we could not even afford. I would have on them shoes, cut cardboard, be warm out, cut cardboard and put in them shoes, you know, keep feet from getting wet and muddy and stuff like that. And I did that. I did that for my family. And this guy what I married, he had come in that community. And I tell you this, at that time too, our young boys were going to World War II. And they cleaned out the community. There wasn't no young boys there. They all was gone to the army. And this single man had come there and got a job and was staying, at renting my house or something out there and staying there. And I happened to go to the store one day from over to the boarding house where I was working, and I saw that strange man in the commissary. And I had never seen him, you know. And I knew in that community where we were, everybody knew everybody. And so when I went home that night, I was telling Mama about it. I said, Mama, I saw a strange black man in the commissary today. I had to go to the store for Miss Georgia. And she said, oh, said that man named Henry Coleman, said he'd been here about 3-4 weeks, said he rent that house out there, and that's where he lived. And I didn't think nothing else about it. And got to the place after that. Occasionally, I'd have to go to the store sometime or be going to Sunday school on Sunday. And he would be standing in the road or talking to somebody. That man looked at me one day, said, I'm going to marry you. And, I hate them on sight, and that's true. Because he took the bottle, you know. And I wouldn't even talk to that man. I didn't speak to that man. Well, times were so hard for us. my uncle, well, I had two uncles, three uncles in that community at that time. And if we ran out of salt or baking powders or something like that, and Mama would send some of the kids over there to Uncle Charlie's house and said, tell May, I said, send me a spoon of baking powder. And he would get very upset. He said, if Julie didn't think she was so much and go on and marry Henry, y'all wouldn't have to ask nobody for nothing, you know. He'd get mad and dog us, you know. And just to tell you the truth, I was pushed into that marriage with somebody I didn't even like. I didn't even like that man.
Was he working in the coal mine?
Oh yeah, he had to be a coal miner to be there. And that's the only industry with that, coal mining. Ain't no do nothing else. Okay. And she done come up.
Tell me, I'm going to jump ahead. Tell me how you met you, Cowens, because we have most of the interview with
you.
Him,
okay.
Both of you.
I married Henry Coleman. And we stayed together 22 years. Had 10 children. You right, take her out of here. We had 10 children, which ended in divorce. By this time, I done left Bell County. We lived in Harlan County. And so during my divorce, well, Hugh Cowens, I knew his mother years before I even knew them because we were real good friends. She helped me with my kids and everything and I worked. And he and his wife, he had a wife, used to come from West Virginia over to Harlem to see his mother. And eventually their marriage ended in divorce. But by this time, he was a preacher. He'd been calling to the ministry. And they marriage had ended in divorce. And he, but before they divorced, he went blind. He said they told him when he come out of the army that one day he might lose his sight because of war injuries when he was in World War II. But he said he come out and worked 12 years before and went fishing one Saturday evening to come back, backed into his garage and went black. Well, the sight went just like that. Mm-hmm. And so after that, he and his, I don't know what their problem was, but I know too, but I'm not going to say. But they finally ended in divorce. And he went to Hines, Illinois, as a school for the blind, and learned Braille and everything, and then come back, and he stayed with his mother. And I used to help him with, that's before he got his Braille Bibles and all that material that he needed. And so eventually, we got married. We got married. I had 10 children by my first husband. And
did you and you have children?
One. These are his grandchildren.
Okay.
We had one daughter, Sylvia. And
I understand that he died a year or so ago.
Yes.
How old was he?
He was 87. He was 87, and we married.
A long time.
Long, we were married, though, about 33 years before he died. That's this picture over there on the wall. And he had a son by a former marriage, but he got killed in a car wreck. And then we had one, cause I didn't think I was gonna ever have any more kids, cause I'm old now, you know. And my baby was 10 years old by my first husband. And this is my baby by the preacher there.
Oh, wow.
That's her.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
And
where does she live?
They live out of Wood Hill.
Okay, here in Lexington.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And these five of these kids are hers.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And so we had the kids. He helped organize the coal at Harlan County. He was in that. We wasn't together in those days, but he was a organizer.
Right. I want to go back. When I talked to you on the phone, and I said to you I wanted to talk about segregation and the effort to integrate in Eastern Kentucky, and you said there wasn't any integration.
Well,
could you talk about that a little bit?
Wait a minute, let me understand what I've said to you.
Well, first off, help me to understand what segregation was like in Eastern Kentucky in the years that you were living there.
Where I grew up, it was a segregation, all right, such as white school, black church, and but they all did the same work, coal mining, maybe different grade levels. But my great-grandmother, she was a midwife, and she helped deliver most of the white and black babies. Everybody called her white and black, either Grandma Kissy or Aunt Kissy. And I told you she ran this boarding house. You go in her dining room, you see them children around that table, you see just many whites as you see black. If they was out there playing meal time, she make everybody come in there, wash up and eat, sit around. And honestly, I didn't even know what integration or segregation was all about till I guess I was about 16. And I used to throw papers in the afternoon, after school, I go get papers and throw papers. And right where I had to pick up my papers, this white family lived there where they throw them off at their house. And they had the prettiest little girl. She's about three or four, something. And she sit out there with me every day to wait on the man to bring the paper. And we talk. And she'd ask me,
"Is a little strong boy in here somewhere?"
I'm sorry about this. I told
it's
you,
okay.
If the kids were, she'd be a lot of interruption. And he working out there. And she would feed everybody eat together by six. Yeah, when I was carrying these papers, and this little girl would come out here every day. We sit there.
Excuse me.
And she wanted to go home with me, you know. And I tell her, I said, "You can't go, Dorothy, honey." I said, "I got to go throw papers." And she was so persistent. "But I want to go home with you, Julia. I want to go play with you." You know, little bless the baby. And so I thought I'd just get off my back. I said, "Well, you ask your mother, and if she say you can go, I I'll take you home for me a little while. So I got my papers and left. The next day I went to get my papers, and she came out and she was pouting. And I said, "Dorothy, what's the matter?" She said, "Julie, I asked my mommy if I could go home with you. And she said, no, I would have to wait till I turned to a nigger. And says, now I told her one of these days, I'm going to get mad and turn black as tar." And that's when it dawned on me, you know, that there was a level that you didn't cross, you know. And that's when I first noticed segregation. Played with white children all my life. We played together, slept together. Cause if dark caught you over on that hill, my grandmother got you in there, you took a bath and got in her bed, and that's where you stayed. Slept with them, ate with them. We had our differences, but it never turned a darn on me that we were segregated like that. And so then after that, I grew up married and we moved to Harlan County. And I saw more of it in Harlan County than in Bell County, or either I just didn't notice it growing up, you know, around it. And when I married Hugh Cown, he come over in West Virginia. Well, that's why he said he was over in West Virginia. They had organized Harlan County, but I wasn't there at that time. And that's why he went to West Virginia to get a job, because he said he couldn't get a job nowhere in Harlan County, being an organizer. Uh-huh.
So when you, what period did you two live in Harlan County? When you met him, what year are we talking about there?
We're talking about 1959.
Okay.
59.
What can you tell me about Harlan County at that point in terms of segregation?
Well, now I can truthfully say this. From what I know, there was never no difference on them little mining communities. You got along with your neighbors or you let them alone. If you couldn't get along with them, you didn't bother them. And I can tell you this too, you didn't bother them, they didn't bother you. We got black and white, as far as I know, never ever had no confrontation till after the segregation thing came about. And then we didn't, I mean, you was my neighbor. We, you know, we talked together, we go to store, we just did the same thing every day together. But it's just some people, if they had their difference, they kept it to themselves and stayed their distance, white and black.
You remember any demonstrations in Harlan?
Now, we were in Edwards. That's where right. We lived, the first place I went in Harlan County. The only... And I don't, it might have been some differences or something there. But none that I know about that I can recall, except this one incident. When they started to integrate, I had, Reverend I called him Rev, he's preaching. We had become, members of the NAACP. I wrote up the first white man in Everett in the NAACP. He was our police chief.
What do you mean? He joined.
He joined. I sat down. We talked to him, and told him the nature of this NAACP. It ain't white against what blacks against white. It's about equal opportunity. If my child education requires him to be a president, why can't he run? Or whatever his ability is. It wasn't no white man married black woman or black man marrying a white woman. And I looked him in his face like I'm looking at you. I said, Marvin, it's not about sex, sexual mess. I said, no, I don't want my son to have your daughter any more than you would want your daughter to have my son. I said, but it's equal opportunity. I said, no, we don't have this. We don't have this year. And I wrote Marvin, the police chief, up, the first man I wrote up. He said, well, Julia, that's the way I am. He said, that's the way I feel about it.
What was his full name? Or his?
We all call him Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke. Okay.
But I know his first name, Marvin. It'll come to me.
Okay.
But I can't think of it. His last name, because everybody said, you know, you get these nicknames. And
right.
But I know his first name.
Was it Tipton or something?
Marvin. I can get it from this.
That's okay. It doesn't. I'm going to turn the tape over here.
Okay. Julia, that's the way it is. He said, that's what I'm for. And he said, you write me up. And I wrote him up first before I wrote anybody else up as a member.
What kinds of activities did the local NAACP do in Harlem?
We listen. Far as, that's what I'm telling you now, in Everett, they had open counters where they served black children going there and sit by the white children, order what they. We never had this problem in Everett.
Okay.
We never did have that problem. We had no problem to confront us, you know, that we had to have meetings and things and all that kind of stuff. My husband and myself set up a junior NAACP. We told them what they knew. We schooled them on what it was all about. Our children got along fine. Boy, them kids raised up together right there. And they would fight for each other. Now I'm gonna tell you about it. This one boy, he didn't live in Everett, but they lived down the road somewhere. I don't even know his name. And he went in the army. He dropped out of school, and he went in the army. And then when he come back out, he went to school to pick up his grades, you know, go back and finish his education. And my nephew. And I guess by this time, son is about 16 or 17. Yeah, about getting ready to come out of school. They got into it. I don't know how it come about or what, but this man pulled a knife, gonna cut this boy, and ran him out of the school. My husband and I, you told just let it, don't, we won't have this, we won't. We went to the chairman of the school board that ran a hardware and furniture store there in Everett. We sat down and talked it out. Mr. Coleman, his name was Carson Coleman. He's what I tell y'all, Hugh said, don't worry about it. He will never go another day in that school. And he didn't. And that went out just like that.
Okay.
Now that's the only incident that I can remember we had in Everett.
Okay.
And far as I know, at Harlem, which was the county seat there, I don't remember of any. Now I didn't live down there. But we lived about 8 or 10 miles up this community where we live. And we started to encourage the children to have sit-ins, because some of them wouldn't serve you in Harlem, that which was no trouble in Everett. And they started to let the children sit in. Didn't have not one, only, it was one drugstore that had, an old drugstore that had a restaurant in there. And he said, before I would serve those people, I shut it down. And that's what he did. Wasn't no hey or yay or nay or nothing about it. He closed it down. I don't remember it being no fighting or fussing, or, and it could have been, and I didn't know about it. But I'm talking about what I know. But I know it didn't happen in Everett, because I was right there and involved in community services. We was sat on the board of the National Equal Right Congress.
And I want to talk to you more about that mm-hmm. organization. What can you tell me about them? And how did you get involved with them?
We got involved by two man and wife, Bess and Chuck. They were in on the national, and involved in the national work. And we had never ever met in the national meetings. And Betsy and Chuck, you ain't gonna believe this, but I've been sick, and a lot of things I forget temporarily, but right. Later on it comes back to me.
No, I understand.
And I'm trying to think of Chuck and Bex's last name. I got some newspapers and things when we were active somewhere in some of these boxes packed up. And they got us involved. We went to Jackson, Mississippi. They flew us down there. And that's where our first meeting was, in Jackson, Mississippi. Wearing them big Band the Klan's button. Mine's in there in my drawer right now. Band the Klan. We went down there. That's where I met with them for the first time, was in Jackson, Mississippi. And I know this much about the National Board. They just don't bring anybody in there, and okay, I know you got to be screened. You know, you got to be a law-abiding citizen. They screen you. You just don't walk in there and say, I'm this, I'm that. It's everything you say gonna have to be proven. You're not a troublemaker, not quick to lose your temper, it's stuff like that, you know.
And the official name was the Equal Rights Congress?
National Equal Rights Congress.
What?
They had every nationality in there but one, and it was the Indian. Now, after I left, they might have got them, but at that time, when we was involved, they had every nationality.
The first meeting that you attended in Jackson would have been about what year are we talking about? In the 70s or the 60s?
Wait a minute. It was in the 70s. It was in the 70s.
And how long did you stay active with them?
I stayed active for about maybe about 3 years, because that's when I went to start to getting sick and everything, you know, like, and a lot of times I should have been going, I couldn't go. Rather than them dragging me along, I'd rather give up my seat, let somebody else take it, you know. And, go ahead.
What, at board, at these meetings of the board, what kinds of issues did you discuss?
We discussed Jesus. Well, we discussed like wait a minute, it's trying to come to me. Inhuman treatments, you know, mistreated by because of the color of your skin, holding you down from jobs, and equal opportunities, and how to deal with these problems without going out, want to kill, shoot, getting guns and things, you know. No, that wasn't ever discussed. It was how you go about handling these situations. You know, nobody don't want to have no war. No, that's out of the question. But how to deal with these things intelligently, soberly, you know, not be bringing about routes, you know, just cause you had a bad something to happen here, don't go routing and things like that, you know. Let the people, that's what the NAACP is for in a community. If a situation break out, instead of grabbing guns and sticks and things, want to fight and kill, let them come together and discuss this stuff and try to work it out right, you know, in the best way you know how. And you can, and I know it can be done. I'm going to tell you, I remember one situation in Harlem now that my mind is kind of working a little bit. This white black boy and white girl going together in school, and she'd been going with that boy. It came out for two school terms, but somehow or the other, somebody caught them. And when she got, because her parents hated black. And when they caught them, she cried rape. She said the boy was raping her. And this went to court. But the NAACP, see, most of the kids knew, the black kids that I have, what was going on. And the NAACP got a lawyer to come in, and we got this lawyer to come in there.
Do you remember his name at all?
He wasn't from Harlem.
We got him out
of Louisville, Kentucky, and he come to Harlem.
Would it have been James Crumlin?
I know his name, but I'm kind of careful about calling folks' name.
Okay.
You know, because then and now is a different time, and something I might say something to interrogate somebody up.
Okay.
But we got this lawyer, and he came to Harlem, and he that morning for the trial, and this guy come walking in, and they knew nobody had gotten no lawyer up there, because everybody in Harlem know everything, you know. But when that lawyer, that black man come in there, and they didn't know where he come from. Just as cool as a cucumber, never raised his voice, soft spoken. Now don't bring in your crown. Take a bath. And he listened to her lawyer. Then when time come, he talked to that girl. Just as soft spoken, because she broke down in tears and admitted that that was her boyfriend. Sure did. And I'm gonna tell you another issue that come up now, that once we got organized in efforts, the white girls, high school was just across the track. I mean, the white high school. In fact, they had integrated at this time. White and black was going to this school. But they could come right out the school and go right up the hill over there. There was a lot of boys up there, like dropouts, and wouldn't attend the school like they should. Them girls would take out of that school and right up that hill, go up that hill up there with them. Black boys were. One man was so towed up. He didn't want his girl on that hill. He said the boys was chasing the girl. I tell you what they did. They locked the school at lunchtime to keep them girls in. But that didn't suit this daddy. My husband, we had issues and things there, we talk about it. My husband told Gunsmoke, said, I want to show you something. So I want you to sit right here on my porch. Said, now, when noon comes, said, I want you to see if the black boys is chasing the white girls or the white girls is chasing the black boys. That was before they put the lock on there, when his daddy was raising so much sand. And at noon, boy, here them girls come up that hill just fast. And the chief of police said they saw it for himself. He saw it for himself. And Rip said, now you see what the problem is there? Say, it's not the black boys chasing the white girls. It's the white girls chasing the black boys.
Okay. I want to ask you just a couple more questions about the National Equal Rights Congress.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll be back through, I think. This has been real good, real helpful. When you went to the meetings of the Congress, about how many people would be present, and where would they come from?
I'm telling you, we had every nationality there, but one that was the Indian. We had the meetings at that time, and he was a black the black governor in Jackson, Mississippi, or black mayor, one of the two of them. I don't think
it's together.
Mayor,
I think.
Uh-huh. Met
Morgan
in that building in Jackson, Mississippi. He was either the mayor or the governor of the state, something.
So you met in a government building?
In that building, yes. It was a government building. Excuse me 1 minute. Turn that off again.
That again. You walked the streets.
We walked the streets, and they was just droves and droves and droves of Jackson, Mississippi, with these big band, the Klan. And I had never heard nothing good about Mississippi in my life, and was scared to death of Jackson, of Mississippi. But we went, And everybody that was walking had on one of these buttons.
And they wanted to get rid of the Klan.
The Klan. They was giving a lot of trouble in that area in that day at that time. I've had that button all this. I kept mine. I don't know what Rev did with his. But this was the button we had on walking the streets of Jackson, Mississippi. Yeah. It took courage. If you were scared, you couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. We integrated a restaurant there. And when we went in to be served, the waiters and things, they were shaking. They were so nervous and scared. The men and women that was in there, they was getting up, getting their hats, leaving out. They never said nothing. They just left.
Were the waiters black or white?
They were white. This was a white restaurant that we were integrating. And them girls was just shaking all over because they didn't know what was going to happen any more than we knew what was going to happen. But we didn't go for trouble. We went to integrate that restaurant. And we had on these buttons.
And did they serve you?
Yes, they did. Okay. Yes, they sure did.
Did you like the food?
It was delicious. I had never in my life, I don't think, had eaten clam chowder until then. And it was good. It was delicious.
That's good.
And the ones that wanted to stay, and I read the whites, they stayed there, they laughed, they talked to us. But the ones that didn't want no part of it, they just politely got up with their wives and whoever, they left. Was not a cross word said.
Did the National Equal Rights Congress have a newsletter or
yes.
printed literature?
Yes, in them days, yes. And if I hadn't done moved so many times, I saved all of the literature I had, but I lost, in the flood. I lost a lot of stuff in the flood.
What flood?
In Harlan County. Back in the 70s, 60s, in the 70s, big floods that washed away everybody there, about just about. But we were so fortunate, that's what I call it. Wasn't that nobody was scared of anybody or anybody went to make trouble, because up there where I come from, buddy, them folks would kill their mama if they got mad enough. So you know we didn't make no difference, but we just, everybody knew everybody, everybody grew up together. You know, and if that's what it take, we'll go along. I'm trying to think of the year that, what's the name of that Duke Klan's leader?
Oh, David Duke.
David Duke come to Harlem and burnt a cross.
So David Duke came and burned a cross.
We lived in Everts. About 1 mile from Everts was called Verda, a little community.
How do you spell that?
V-E-R-D-A, Verda, Kentucky. David Duke burned, and them folks come there and burned a cross. And I'm gonna tell you something, honey. My oldest children at that time, my oldest son, had just graduated from high school. The white boys that had graduated and left, some was in Cincinnati, some was in Indiana, Detroit, they migrated different places. But when they read about them Klansmen were gonna meet in Verda, them boys came home. These white boys
to get with the black boys. They bought all kind of ammunition. Yes, they did. My son told me, he said, Mama, little place about a half a mile from where we live called Kildare. He said, I just come from Kildare. And he said, Mama said, I've been over on Kildare Hill. And I said, what you doing over there? He said, he went to naming all the boys that come home when they read about this cross burning and all gonna be there in Verda. Them white boys came home and he said, Mama said, you ought to see the ammunition and things they got. Said, look like an arsenal. And these white boys and armed all of these black boys.
Did they ever have to?
Wait, they had the meeting down there in Verda. Them white boys was all, and black boy all up in the trees up around there. They in the trees up on the hill there, prepared for anything they wanted to start. But as God would have it, they burnt the cross.
Mama!
Come here, you come to me now. And as God would have it, David Duke made his speech. David Duke made his speech. It came out. Now the Harlem paper didn't put out much about it. The Harlem Daily Enterprise. But the Louisville Times, they were there. All the media there was there from everywhere. And he made this big speech. The Louisville Times got it. And if I wrote a response to David Duke. I wrote a response in the Harlem Coal Miners paper. They had just started that coal mining paper, and I know everybody in Harlan County would get one. And I wrote a response to David Duke. But always been some trying in close time, but we never had no physical action. And maybe I might find that paper, because I got it somewhere, and would send it to you so you can read it for yourself.
I'd make a copy and bring the original back.
Yeah, I got it, but I got to find it.
Before we stop, let me just ask you, how many children do you have, and how many grandchildren do you have, and how many great-grandchildren do you have?
I got 10 living children. I had 11, raised 11 out of 16 pregnancies. But I lost my son last year, right after I lost my husband. I never buried a grown child, and he was 45. So I got 10 living now that I birthed, but I raised foster children. I raised two that my husband people, family had died, mother and father. I raised that boy and girl. That was her on the phone just now talking to me. And I foster kids, that record down there, foster kids show you how many foster kids that I've been had in my home. And one boy that foster care could not do nothing with, Gene Jones, black boy. They had sent him out of state time and again. And in state, he wouldn't stay nowhere. They just couldn't do. This boy was 16 years old when they brought him in my house over on East Field Street. They said, wanted to know if I could just keep him over the weekend till they could find a place to keep him. And I told him, yeah. And he said, you could just tell he had a grudge against the world. And I said, I talked to Gene, me and my husband. We said, Gene said, we got you here for the weekend. Now, we're not going to mistreat you. We're not going to abuse you. Nobody in this house is going to do it. And you are not going to do that to nobody here. As long as you're in my house, I said, won't work. You be nice, because that's what we going to be. I talked, you know how old that boy was when he left my house? 21. And didn't want to leave then. They got the record down there. They couldn't find, nobody could have that boy.
How many grandchildren do you have?
Got about, oh my Lord, about, I got about, I think I got about 45 grandchildren, wow. The last count I had. Okay.
And great grandchildren?
I got about 25 great grandchildren. And I got about 8 great grands. Great, great grands.
It's a big family.
It is a family. The fifth, you see that little baby, that's my fifth generation. Wow. My mama lived to see her fifth generation. Wow. That boy was 20 years old when she died. And that was her fifth generation.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
I'm going to stop the tape. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.